Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to Radio Sai's Talking Book Session. This is a presentation of select excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. We are now at Chapter 9, entitled Return to Vrindavanam. At the outset, the author quotes Rabindranath Tagore, who said, quote, "Unknown to me, my king, thou didst press the signet of eternity upon many a fleeting moment," unquote. After having witnessed the miraculous production of Amrita, or fragrant nectar, on their way back from the hills to Baba's ashram in Vrindavan, Mr. Moffat was gripped by its strange mystery, its power, and its quality. So he decided to ask Baba about it at the first opportunity. And when the seeker truly seeks, God cannot but provide. Similarly was the case with the author. At a group meeting the day after, Swami explained to the Moffats the inner significance of the ambrosia known as Amrita and its creation. But before Mr. Moffat shares the explanation Baba gave in this regard, he tells the readers of the Hindu legend attached to it.
Once in the days of old, a great rishi cursed Indra, the king of the lower gods. Some rishis apparently had such tremendous power. As a result, the gods and the three worlds began to lose their vigor. Vishnu, the preserver, one of the trinity forming the Hindu supreme godhead, and therefore higher than Indra, offered the gods a solution. He told them that to save themselves, they must churn the ocean of milk until from it they produced the invigorating elixir called Amrita. This nectar would overcome the rishi's debilitating curse and renew the strength of the gods, and hence that of the three worlds over which they hold dominion. For the churning operation, Vishnu told them they could employ Mount Mandara as a stick and the great snake Vasuki as a rope for turning the stick. Also, he said, the gods must make an alliance with the demons and persuade them to pull one end of the rope, the snake, while the gods pulled the other. In this way, Mount Mandara could be turned, just like a stick in an old-fashioned Hindu churn. Many difficulties arose in the great churning operation. For one thing, the poor snake was badly battered, and venom poured from his mouth in a great river, which threatened to destroy all creatures. To save the situation, Shiva, another member of the High Trinity, appeared and drank the poison. The only harm he suffered was a slightly burned throat, causing a blue patch there, and that is why Shiva is also known as Nilakanta, meaning blue throat. Eventually, however, the stirring up brought good results, and many wonderful things came out from the ocean of milk as byproducts of the churning. Finally, the main product appeared. Dhanvantari, the doctor of the gods, and incidentally the inventor of the Ayurvedic system of medicine, which is still practiced in India, stepped forth from the ocean. In his hand, he carried the gleaming cup of Amrita, the elixir of eternal youth and vigor. Immediately, the quick-thinking demons grabbed the cup from him and fled. But to help the gods, Vishnu appeared among the demons as a seductive woman. Then, forgetting the precious liquor of immortality, they began to fight amongst themselves for possession of the woman. During the conflict, Vishnu snatched the cup of Amrita and bore it to the disconsolate gods. They eagerly drank, each having a share before the cup was empty. Thus, they regained their immortal strength and released new power and vigor into the worlds of gods and men.
But this is just about the legend associated with the Amrita. What was the real significance of this episode? The true meaning of this story? Here's how Swami explained the essence.
The cream of truth, wisdom and immortality symbolized by Amrita must be churned from the great cosmic ocean, the phenomenal universe in which we live and move. Because this universe is based on and must always operate on the principle of opposites, the evil forces, the demons, are as necessary as the good forces, the gods, for the churning, that is, for the continuous struggle in the lives of men. But unfortunately, most men are like the demons. They forget the priceless product, immortality, in their chase after transient sense pleasures, symbolized by the illusion of a seductive woman. Once Amrita, that is, falsehood, enters into the character, Sai Baba said, men lose contact with Amrita. He dies many deaths who is false, afraid of truth, blind to his own glorious heritage of immortality. So, he explained, when people fall a prey to pride, to attachment, to unreality, their thoughts and feelings have to be churned to bring out the dream of spiritual truth. The groups on either end of the churning rope are always the forward-leading influences and the backward-pulling influences, the gods and the demons, or, looked at in another way, the divine and animal forces within ourselves.
Even in today's business-centric world, this simple yet profound wisdom holds a lot of significance. But for Mr. Murfitt, this was not all. He was to witness much more.
After some 12 days on the Olympian heights of Horsley, we returned to Whitefield. On this journey, Iris and I had the honor and joy of sitting with Swami in the leading car. For miles along the road, Baba led the car load in songs of praise to God, most of which were composed by himself. These were some of the songs used daily in the bhajan sessions at the ashram or anywhere else that Sai Baba happens to be. As we were entering a village along the route, two busloads of people passed us and recognized Baba. In the village street just ahead, they stopped, piled out and formed a human roadblock. My own instinct would have been to sound the horn loudly and force a way through what looked like a rough crowd. But Swami seems never to feel any alarm or annoyance with the milling mobs that often surround him. The only reactions I have ever seen from him are love and understanding, though sometimes people lose all restraint in their desire to get near him and touch him. On this occasion, he told the driver to stop, then opening his side window, he leaned out and gave his blessings. As the crowd, now smiling happily, parted for us, we drove slowly through, while Baba waved and spoke to the people on either side. It was like riding with a royal personage, only much more than that. On the faces of these country folk, there was a radiance that nearly moved one to tears.
At Vrindavan, Swami decided that Mr. Murfitt and his wife should stay with him in his residence. He gave them a room for their stay and played the role of a perfect host. It was here that they saw some new facets of Swami's character. What was it? How did the events unfold? Let us now find out.
Before we moved in, he called some of the young men who are ever happy to serve him and set them to work cleaning the room thoroughly and rearranging the furniture. I have never seen Indians move so fast or work as efficiently as they did under Swami's supervision. He would let neither my wife nor me move a finger to help, yet he himself gave a hand in the work. From somewhere, he brought attractive carpets, curtains, and drapes. Finally, he installed us, apologizing that the room was not more comfortable. But we loved it, and we could not help admiring Swami in this new role of works supervisor and interior decorator. Whatever is done by him, at whatever level, is done supremely well. Baba decided to give my wife and myself the Hindu ceremony known as Shashtipurti. This is a kind of pre-marriage performed when the husband has reached his 60th birthday. For the ceremony, Swami presented Iris with a beautiful new silk sari and me with a white silk dhoti and angavastram, saying that it was correct for us to wear new attire on the occasion. We sat cross-legged on the low stage while two priests from Prashanthi Nilayam performed the colorful ritual. Before us were a large coconut, some bananas, bowls of rice, sandalwood paste, saffron, kumkum, incense, and other things. These were essential items of the ritual. The priests chanted Sanskrit mantras, and at specified times they sprinkled something from one of the bowls onto the coconut or smeared it with a paste. Baba was sitting to one side, watching and sometimes directing the proceedings. At the right moment, he stepped forward, waved his magic hand in the accustomed way, and materialized two gold rings, each set with a large precious stone. One was for me to put on my wife's finger, and the other for her to put on mine. After that, Baba handed us long garlands of flowers with which to adorn each other, and one was given for both of us to place together over Swami's head. The ceremony finished with a chant by the two pundits in unison, invoking, we were told, the blessings of a long life under the protection and guidance of Sri Satya Sai Baba. The whole ritual was radiant with the warm love that flows from Swami. One could not help feeling that for some 40 minutes, unseen beneficent powers had been focused on us and on our marriage union. Thus it was renewed and supremely blessed. Next day came the ceremony, which Baba said must follow Shashtipurti, feeding and clothing the poor. Word had gone out to the villages in the neighborhood, and about 1,000 paupers, men, women, and children, were shepherded into the grounds of Vrindavanam. They sat in rows to receive a substantial rice meal cooked and served by a number of Baba's devotees. Then 60 of the most destitute men and the same number of women were brought to sit on either side of the drive within the inner garden. Each woman was to receive a sari and each man a dhoti. As it was our ceremony, Iris and I were to have the job of handing out these goods, but it was Sai Baba who had provided them.
Along this chapter, the author points out that apart from the important ceremonial occasion of Shivratri, Sai Baba did not usually do spectacular materializations before large audiences. But he personally saw him do it once to honor Dr. Modi, and there could hardly have been a more deserving recipient.
Dr. Sri Murugappa Chennavirappa Modi is known throughout India and in medical circles abroad as an eye surgeon and ophthalmologist. But to the 6 million blind of India, he is much more than that. He is a hope for light in their darkness. They call him our brother who gives sight. Son of a Bombay merchant, he became a medical practitioner in that city in 1940, specializing in eye surgery. In 1943, he gave up his private practice and began his now famous pre-treatment eye camps. With his headquarters in the Mysore town of Davanagere, he usually sets up his mobile hospital in a school loaned by the grateful town authorities. Anybody in the district, rich or poor, may come and have their eye troubles examined and treated without any charge. Pre-hospitalization is provided in the school building. The eye camp generally lasts for about 2 weeks, and in that time, Dr. Modi treats thousands of cases. While he corrects squints and other optical troubles, the bulk of his operations are for cataracts. But Dr. Modi accepts no fees for himself. I met Modi when he was brought to Whitefield. He was there with Mr. Naik, the collector, to take Sai Baba to Kolar. Baba had agreed to be present at the closing function of an eye camp just completed in this town, about 30 miles from Whitefield. I was lucky enough to be invited to go with them. Outside the large school building where the eye hospital had been conducted, a crowd of about 5,000 was waiting. Dr. Modi, who had been sitting near me at the side of the stage, went to the microphone. As he spoke in the local dialect, I could not understand much of what he said, but I picked up one point. He said that although he worked to cure physical blindness, we were all of us spiritually blind until our inner eyes were opened by a great teacher such as Sai Baba. When he had finished, but before he could return to his seat, Baba stood up beside him and waved his theurgic hand in several swift circles. There was a flash of gold as between Baba's thumb and forefinger appeared a solid gold ring set with a large ruby. This he slipped neatly and firmly onto the doctor's third finger. A deep hush passed over the crowd of watchers before they broke into delighted applause. The doctor seemed quite overcome with emotion when he sat down again and gave me and others a close look at the beautiful ring. It fitted his finger as if measured for it.
Later in this chapter, the author mentions how from that day, Dr. Modi became a part of the great Sai family. Early the following year, Baba invited him to run one of his humanitarian eye camps at Prashanthi Nilayam itself. People from miles around came for free treatment, and many of the ashramites acted as hospital assistants. Later the same year, I observed the good doctor taking an active part in the Satya Sai World Conference in Bombay. After the public meeting at Dr. Modi's eye camp, when the group was set to leave, Mr. Murfitt noticed a ring identical to Dr. Modi's with Mr. Sheshagiri Rao. Knowing there would be an interesting story behind it, he questioned Sheshagiri.
Baba, Mr. Sheshagiri said, produced the ring in his usual way with a hand wave. But at first, it did not have the Baba image in the emerald. So he said that since he could buy such a piece for himself, what he really wanted was a ring showing Sai Baba's image. Hearing this, Swami took the ring back, held it in his hand for a moment, and then returned it. The unmistakable silhouette had appeared in the stone while Baba held it in his hand. Then with another hand wave, Baba produced its twin, bearing the same Sai image for G. Venkateshwar Rao.
Beautiful experiences indeed. But we will have to stop at this point. More when we get together again. Meanwhile, if you have missed any of the earlier reading book sessions of Sai Baba, Man of Miracles, please visit our website at www.radiosai.org. That's www.radiosai.org. And in our archive page, key in the words Man of Miracles, and you will find the links to all the previous chapters. Wishing you all the very best from Prashanthi Nilayam, thank you for tuning in, and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.